listeners, Global Live Radio. I'm your host this evening, Debbie Edwards. We have a really great guest today. We're going to be talking to Peter Canova, the author of Pope Annalisa. Now, this book, I got to tell you guys, this is something really phenomenal. But before we get into the topics of discussion there with Peter, I do want to go ahead and let everybody know you're welcome to participate in our show today by logging into our chat room. It just takes a couple moments to establish a Blog Talk Radio account to participate, or you can just log in as a guest and go ahead and listen in. As well, you're also welcome to call in on the call line to be able to listen through. Our call-in number is 646-716-6198. And if you can't catch the whole broadcast, don't worry. You can go ahead and listen to our archives once we go ahead and conclude our broadcast. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about our author. This is basically what we want to go ahead and talk about, which we're going to talk about his book there, Pope Annalisa. But the author himself, from the time he first experienced phenomena such as telepathy, remote viewing, intuitive medical readings, and psychic healing, Peter Canova has spent much of his life seeking to understand the forces that link humanity together at an unseen level. His former businesses, hotel development, shipping, and import-exporting, carried him around the world, where he met a variety of spiritual figures, each of whom appeared in his life unsolicited and confirmed his conviction that spirit transcends the religious beliefs that tend to divide people. In his book, Pope Annalisa, he explores an ancient spiritual tradition which cuts across not only Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also the so-called pagan mystery schools of ancient days. So I also want to let everybody know, as a congratulations to Peter, he is also a two-time award-winning author for this book who has won the Nautilus Award in two separate categories. So with that said, Peter, welcome to the show.
Hello, Debbie. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, you as well. So before we get into the topics of the book, congratulations on the awards.
Well, thank you. And actually, since you got the news about the two awards, Pope Annalisa has won a third award. It won the Gold Award in the Nautilus. Nautilus is a series of competitions. In order to get to the gold round, you have to win the silver. So it actually won two silvers, and now it has won the Gold Award for Visionary Fiction, which I was very happy to find out just the other day.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I'm really, really proud, you know, and it's something that I myself, which I do want to say thank you for forwarding a copy of the book to me before its debut date of, you know, published release. I just want to say that the book itself for me, you know, in this, of course, you know, I eat up every single topic about religion, spirituality, you know, mysticism and the whole nine. And for me, the book was very, very compelling because it really shows a lot of the truth between different, you know, religious divisions, as well as a lot of the, well, how do I put it, you know, traditions within churches that have really kind of segregated people from spirit. So, you know, I just want to say that the book for me was something that, you know, resonated with me personally, and getting back to a lot of the roots, you know, with the book. I wanted to ask, you know, and if you could share with our listeners, what led you to really research her and go forward and put this together? Where was your inspiration?
Well, I think it was a number of things. First of all, as you mentioned in my little bio, when I was younger, I had some pretty startling experiences in terms of recognizing that there is a spiritual source that connects all of us, a universal mind. And rather than say that, a lot of people sort of say that and they read it and it's an article of faith, but this was actual experiences I had that put me in contact with this higher intelligence in the form of intuitive medical readings and some of the other things I did. And it led me to really believe that we are all connected at an unseen level, and there really is something more than the physical world that we're all so fixated on. And that was both a comforting and, you know, a startling and comforting revelation to me. And after that, it became almost, well, magnetized in a way. Your spirituality starts to attract other people into your life that tend to reaffirm and help you learn and grow with the base that you've already started with. And as I traveled around the world, including Nigeria, where the book is set, I lived in Africa for several years.
Okay. Well, that's really fascinating. You know, what were some of your experiences there?
It was a land of conflict. It was very heavy, spiritually speaking. When I meditated, I felt a lot of denseness over me at that time. This was the part of Africa where the slave trade was active. In fact, most of our African-American population in this country came from the areas of Africa where I was living, the western part of Africa, Nigeria, Benin, Dahomey, that area. And there had been really a lot of it had a very dark history. And I was very conscious that my meditations, it would intrude my meditations a lot over there. It was also a land where there were a lot of current conflicts in that it's the most populous country in Africa, but half the country is Muslim and half the country is Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the borderline of friction between the two different worldviews, between the two different religions. And, of course, that was one of the reasons of this conflict between radical Islam and the West was one of the major plot lines of the book. And because it was so evident in Nigeria, one of the reasons I guess I naturally gravitated was for that reason. But as far as the character of Annalisa was concerned, there were other reasons involved. For one thing, the spirituality that's depicted in Pope Annalisa stands in stark contrast to the Christianity that most of us have grown up with, or even the Judeo-Christian tradition, in that it's a spirituality that is more feminine in character, and it's much closer to the rhythms of the earth and nature. In Nigeria, there was still a large animist population, what you would call native religion, shamans, bush doctors. I hung around with quite a few bush doctors. And it lacked all the sophisticated dogmas and traditions and rules and regulations of the Catholic Church. So it stood in very stark contrast. It was a much more direct, let's say, a direct line to spirit. And that's another reason that I chose Africa for the setting of the book, and chose a woman because this spiritual tradition that I discuss in the book was feminine in nature. It's a tradition that cut through so many of our major religions today, and it wasn't a religion. It's just so people know what we're talking about, because we've mentioned this mystic tradition several times. It's very hard. It's rather complex, and it doesn't easily lend itself to one overarching definition. But an abbreviated description would tell us that human beings are physical entities containing projections of God's own spiritual essence. This means that humans are emanations or expressions of the infinite in finite form here on earth for the purpose of evolving God's consciousness into matter. Now, that stands in very stark contrast to what we've been taught in our Western religions, which basically say that humans were created, to use a Latin term, ex nihilo, or out of nothing. Think of like clay dolls who were somehow granted life force, and then they went off the track and they sinned and God got mad at us and we've been suffering ever since. That's the Western religion story. But it's a very different thing when you say that you are actually projections of God's own substance and that you're here for a learning experience. And that, of course, they viewed the human beings as actual spiritual vibrations who were slowed down and condensed into seemingly solid forms, like almost like a holographic representation of a true underlying reality. But if you remember the old Star Trek shows, the old holodeck on Star Trek, I guess it was Next Generation. Well, a holographic program can be deceptively real. And so in this spiritual tradition, the spirit essence that is in humans became overwhelmed by the denseness of materiality. And it's sort of like a kind of amnesia. Spirit began to identify with the material body through the agent of free will and forgot its divine origin. So enlightenment occurs when each person has an actual experience of the truth of the underlying reality behind the program. And think of the movie The Matrix. The goal of all those guys in The Matrix was to get unplugged from the mainframe so that they could see true reality. Well, The Matrix was really a very astute movie, and really that's what this ancient tradition was telling us, that we are sort of asleep in this dream of materiality, but that's not our true home. And the experience that I told you that I had as a young man was a direct contact with this energy, with this intelligence, which really kind of pierced the veil for me and showed me that there is something behind it. And that's what this, a lot of what this tradition that I'm speaking about tells us in the book.
Yeah. Well, and I'm really glad that you approach it that way too, and, you know, your description of it, because I really think a lot of people right now, they're having so many experiences, so many profound experiences, that one of two things is happening. Either it creates this confusion and despair, or it creates this process of illumination. And I completely agree with you. You know, when we look at different types of film and media, such as The Matrix, you know, really when we're trying to unplug from all of these fear-based, dogmatic experiences that kind of keep us blind and in the dark, you know, that's what I liked about this book, is that it was something that, it's not so much because it challenges the traditions of the church as it is it helps to bring awareness and brings us back to the true principles and teachings of, you know, what these prophets were really trying to, you know, reveal, such as Christ, you know. And I'm curious of where you stand on the aspect, and I have this theory, it's something that I received in meditation, is that at the time, you know, Christ had come, there were actually several of his, I don't want to say spiritual understanding of his vibration, but what I was shown is that there were several at the same time, simultaneously, in different continents of the globe, trying to teach, you know, really coming back to the soul source and coming back to the source of love and understanding, acceptance, and really working with energy. And I'm curious if that is something that you have experienced as well.
Well, not experienced it per se in terms of actually seeing particular historical figures in different areas of the world at that time, but the theory of what you're saying I completely agree with, because the ancient mystical tradition really was something that started in Sumeria and it went to the Middle East, India. It was the source of wisdom, spiritual wisdom, that was in all the ancient mystery schools. The best one that we probably think of here in the West is the Oracle of Delphi and the various mystery schools in Egypt that were teaching this spiritual wisdom. And in the West, that tradition was carried on by a group called the Gnostics. Now, there were two early streams of Christianity. There were the Orthodox Christians, or what evolved into the Orthodox Christians, who became the current churches that we have today, the Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Protestant churches were descendants from the Orthodox branch of Christianity. And then there were the Gnostics. The Gnostics embraced the Christian story, and in terms of what you were just saying, Debbie, they saw Christ as one of a line of redeemers who would incarnate for purpose of enlightening humanity, and that these redeemers would appear at different times or sometimes even simultaneously in the world in order to set humanity back on its general spiritual course. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, the great Indian spiritual epics, they have Krishna saying that when evil is on the rise and good is in trouble, that he will incarnate from age to age to set the balance back and put virtue back on its throne. In the West, sometimes they call this dispensationalism, but what it really means is that, yes, this wisdom was a chain of enlightenment that was put to the world through different prophets and different divine incarnations in different ages, but always with the purpose of setting our spiritual course back so that we don't fall into complete darkness and ignorance.
Yeah. Well, and I absolutely agree with that. And I know that for me personally, a lot of the dreams, the visions, and the meditations I've received, it's very synchronistic with that. There's been several people I've spoken to who have received, you know, a parallel message too with that. And, you know, when we look at the political climate, the social climate, and of course the spiritual climate of everything that's happening simultaneously right now, to me it makes sense, you know, as we're really bridging this gap, you know, between these segregated concepts and these different theological, I don't want to say, you know, ideas are really not so much ideas, but, you know, they've been kept hidden, they've been kept boxed away for so long, you know, and we're starting to see where things are branching out, and we're noticing, you know, this new expression of spirituality and of understanding, you know, so much more of an understanding of where our origin is in things of that manner.
I think that one of the things that really is, I guess, a major theme of the book is spirit transcending religion. This is not a church bashing book. There's a lot of books out there that spend, I think, a lot of negative time and energy just ragging on the Catholic Church in particular. And look, the Catholic Church had its periods of history and still has its moments where it always doesn't stand for the highest and the best, but you can say that about every human being and every religion that ever was. What this book really tries to make people aware of, at least on the historical side of it, is that take the three major Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They all started with the mystical core, believing this wisdom, and kind of along the lines of what you and I are talking about now, believe it or not, and the remnants of it still survive today. So in Judaism, you have the Kabbalah. In Christianity, you had Gnosticism. And in Islam, you have the Sufis. Now, the Sufis, the Kabbalists, and the Gnostics were the mystics of their three respective religions. And yet, they were suppressed by their outer religions in almost every case. Now, unfortunately, Christianity did the best job and pretty much destroyed the Gnostics. The Kabbalah and Judaism and the Sufis have survived a little bit better. But these three mystical cores have more in common with one another than they actually have with their outer religions. But the Gnostics would tell you, although the Orthodox really did a good job in destroying the Gnostics, both in terms of their works and even physically eradicating them, the Gnostic view of the Orthodox Church was that, look, the outer church, what they called the outer church, the church of the sort of the dogmas and the rituals, that's spirituality 101. It kind of gives you the basic precepts, but the whole purpose is to get more spiritually mature and graduate beyond that and go into a more personal perception. Whereas in the Orthodox Church, they kind of stop right there at the dogmas and the rituals, and that's where when people get stuck in that vibrational level, that's where all the powers of ego and materiality and control can come in, and we have some of those manifestations which we all know about today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I agree with you with what you're saying as far as the book, because it is not a book that bashes, you know, church and religion. It's to help us really see beyond, you know, all of these confinements of things that have really kept us separate from reaching within to find, you know, the soul, the God source of self within. And that's what I really like about the book, is it not only does it bridge the gap in that aspect, but it also talks about, you know, the political turmoil. You know, that's what I actually hadn't expected that, even though it was something that, you know, when I started reading, I was, you know, preparing for, you know, the type of conflicts that she would have encountered. But when we look at, you know, the type of conflict that's going on when it comes to government and political and how we see, you know, this complete merge, this blend of church and state, really, even though it shouldn't, but it is there. You know, it was something that I think is an important thing to put forth, because, you know, I also look at it this way too, is that, you know, bringing this to the table helps us recognize and understand a lot of what is happening globally, you know, between, you know, what modern Western Christianity, and then, of course, you have Muslim faith, and you have, you know, this stark divide. I liked that it brought that to the attention in the book, you know, especially being what we're experiencing now, you know, throughout our country and, of course, throughout the world.
Well, I think that sometimes God must be sitting up there laughing quite a bit, because our conceptions about God always change and we argue over them, but God doesn't really change. It's only our conceptions of God that cause these divisions at a real spiritual level. When you have a spiritual experience like I had, and I think perhaps you have had and many other people have had, the first thing that you really experience is the mm-hmm. feeling of oneness and the connectedness and the information coming through that's saying, you know, I can know what you're doing and you can know what I'm doing, and I can understand you at a deeper level than just talking with you, because we're all, you know, connected by that that energy source. So there wouldn't really be these kind of arguments if if we had a true spiritual consciousness as opposed to what we have with religions. But this might be a good time to just maybe tell the listeners a little bit about Pope Annalisa, because it's really two stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really two stories. It's a thriller, and it's set in the near future about a miracle-working African nun. It's a world where resources of oil and water have become scarce. Iran has gone nuclear. The friction between the great powers is getting ready to boil over, and Annalisa is down in the back country of Africa, performing these miracles outside the control and without the sanction of the church. And some of the Muslims in Nigeria converting because of her healing. So she's really upsetting the power structure, the delicate balance between Christianity and Islam down in Nigeria, which is this flashpoint of tensions between the two religions. And there's also an established body of Catholic prophecy that's predicted the rise of a great heretic who is going to destroy the church from within. So right away, the church hierarchy is very suspicious of Annalisa. But through a stunning series of events, beginning with her healing the current pope, who was very ill, she rises to become a cardinal, and ultimately, in a very surprising event that occurs in the Sistine Chapel, when the pope dies and they go to elect a new pope, she becomes the first female pope. And I'm not going to give the book away and tell everybody
sure.
what happens there, but
sure.
it's quite an interesting scene. But, you know, immediately upon assuming the papacy, demonic symbols begin appearing around the Vatican. She reverses 2,000 years of Catholic traditions. America goes to war with Iran, and it's about to go nuclear. So you're really asking yourself at this point, and a lot of people in the book, even some of the ones who supported her, asking, is she the cure or the cause? Is she the builder or the destroyer of this harsh new world? And I imagine a lot of people must have asked the same questions about the advent of Jesus in the turbulent Palestine of his time. Somebody who's performing miracles, you know, what is he about? The high priest thought, of course, that he was a sorcerer and he was evil, and the people he healed certainly didn't feel that way, but great figures like that always are usually looked at it two different ways. It's not always a unanimous decision while they're alive. But the parallel story here, the one behind the scenes, explores this lost spiritual tradition that we've been talking about. And I might mention something that's really very interesting to let people know that this spiritual wisdom, the tradition that's spoken of in the book, it has definite historical roots. This is not something that has been made up. It's something that I have not only meditated on, but researched for over 25 years. And the seers or the mystics who practiced this tradition penetrated these higher realms or dimensions of information to a startling extent, where they actually predated and described many of the advanced theories that we have today in science and quantum physics. Einstein's theory of relativity, the Big Bang, the information theory. Let me give you some specific examples. The ancients would have said matter and the human form is a gross form of a higher energy crystallized into a lower vibration. Well, essentially that's what Einstein's theory of relativity said. Matter and energy are interchangeable. The ancients said that our universe was emanated or projected from a series of pre-existing universes. Exactly what the parallel universe says, that we live side by side with other pre-existing dimensions. The Earth is alive with a divine intelligence that created it. That's exactly what the strong Gaia theory says. And then we talked a little bit about its relation to the holographic theory, about the way the world is illusion, because this is a sort of a representation or a holographic projection of a deeper reality. And finally, they said that the material universe was expelled from ten or more higher dimensions. And this is exactly what the Big Bang and string theories are saying right now, that our universe, our visible universe, was a contraction of 10 or more dimensions down to 3. Now, you've got to ask yourself the question, 2,000-3,000 years ago, how could they be perceiving truths that we're only now rediscovering in the quantum physical realm? Well, what it really says is that they weren't smoking desert weed. These guys weren't employing meditation to fantasize on things, because there's a big difference between fantasy and information that you get from real meditation and contact with this divine intelligence. So they were able to bring back this information, which allowed them to create a whole elaborate series of myths and other ways to communicate the things they saw to the human race that would speak about the human race's origin and destiny and so forth. And it's really, in my mind, when the writings of those ancient mystics start to correlate so closely with what we are now discovering in the objective or external world through science, it might be the intersection of that internal subjective information with the external science that we're now discovering. And at those points where they intersect, maybe that's the closest that we come to the truth of our existence.
Yeah, Absolutely. Well, you know, and it's something that when we really start to explore all of these, you know, these inner truths, it's something that really brings us back to a foundation of peace. And you know, when we look at all of the things that are causing conflict in our world, both private and public, you know, it think it's really a matter of trying to reestablish peace and trying to bring that, you know, peace of mind back into the state of being, you know, because as far as how we're interconnected, you know, our energetic connection, our, you know, that's something as you're speaking, all of these things that you're saying, you know, these are also passions of mine too. And when you really look at the inner dialogue and the language that we speak to each other that's nonverbal, that's energetic, you know, we really get back to the soul source. And, of course, when we look at the spirit that is, you know, contained within a physical vessel, you know, I think a lot of times some things get lost in translation. The memories fade of, you know, our origin, of, you know, our interconnectedness. And, you know, I think it becomes an imbalanced experience in which, you know, there's competition and, you know, who has less, who has more. And you know, really the principle of balance, you know, slips away.
Yeah, and in terms of balance, one of the themes that, since you've been reading the book, you've probably detected that one of the themes in the book was the two must become one, that we must balance our male and female energies within mm-hmm. each of us so that we employ simultaneously the faculties of logic on one side, intuition on the other side. We use our brain-directed activities along with our heart-directed activities. These are things that Jesus was saying in the Gnostic Gospels that they recovered in Egypt in 1945. Jesus was repeatedly saying this, that the two must become one. And we have gone into a period of time where obviously we're out of balance. The patriarchal world that we live in, male-dominated world, has been that way for a long time. Now, it hasn't always been that way. Once the Earth Mother ruled and you had a form, and incidentally the spiritual tradition really grew out of that more feminine, earth-based or naturally-based spiritual form, and it was overwhelmed in successive centuries. But one of the reasons I made the character a woman here is to underscore the fact that we must look at a restoration of these feminine intuitive qualities and other qualities to come into balance with what we've been taught as a society, because when we go away from our intuitive core, we tend to make a lot of mistakes. Logic can lead you to a lot of dead ends, because logic is a phenomenon that by and large operates within the material world, whereas intuition is something that is really connected to a higher sense. It's the gateway to a higher sense that gives us better information. It's like anything else. The higher up you are in the mountain, the more you see. The more you see, the better choices you can make.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true, too, because I think, you know, when we look at our personal experiences, which for me, when I compare, and it's not so much to compare it, but when I compare knowing versus belief, and, you know, really when somebody is able to experience the knowing because they experience the truth for themselves of what they realize is truth, you know, it completely changes the whole dynamic of how they express it. And, you know, and when we look at, you know, spirituality and what's true for them, I know for me, when it comes to doing a session for somebody for after-death communication or a psychic reading or whatever, you know, explaining the dynamic of the relationship of energy between the other side and here, or, you know, people that are still here connected together, you know, it's something that somebody can hear me say it all they want to, but unless they personally experience something on their own that can validify what they believe, they don't experience the knowing. And that's what I like about the book, is because it projects a lot of questions. It brings out, you know, a lot of these personal truths, but really universal truths too. And I think it helps people ask the questions they need that will provide the answers through the experience that they then end up having after.
And that's what I really hope to accomplish. You know, I'm not trying to start a new religion. I'm not trying to become a religious guru or spiritual guru in any sense here. I always describe myself not as an enlightened person, but a person who has glimpsed enlightenment. And I'm trying to share that with other people to get them out of the box and get them to look at themselves, the world around them in a different way that might open some doors for them to start them along a different path, and a path that they can make their own, not a path where they're subscribing to beliefs of others. And you hit on a very important topic. In many ways, one of the central themes of the book here is about graduating from faith to knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Because faith is something that you take, well, you really, you know, exactly what it means. You take it on faith. It means you don't really know for sure, but somebody else has kind of told you it, and then you think on it and you say, well, that sounds right, and then you sort of develop a belief around the faith. There's a big difference between that and knowing, because knowing derives directly from experience.
Yeah,
if you think about burning yourself on a stove, if you've never experienced fire before, and you think about burning yourself with fire, you can't really imagine what it's like. But if you stick your finger in the flame and ouch, all of a sudden it's yours. That pain is yours. You take it with you forever. You know what it's like, and it's a reality to you. And you've gone now from faith to knowledge.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And how is somebody supposed to really follow through on a conviction unless it's something that personally resonates with them? And, you know, they can attach to, other people's wisdom and other people's, teachings and all of these other things. But when it comes to their own personal way of relating to it, there's a gap. There's something missing. And so, of course, I mean, there's that continual searching. And what I liked about there was one part in the book that, talked about, how is it that people attend in a congregation, but they look to psychiatrists and psychologists and all these people outside for counsel and for healing and for therapy. Why is this not taking place in the church? There's this gap. Because how is it that, we're not able to relate to one another to facilitate healing? And, I liked that point made, because when we take a look at what's happening in our societies today, and you can bridge it to different countries as well as the U.S. and things, and when we look at people that attend a mass or service to receive, words of wisdom, to receive healing and guidance, there's still a little bit missing. And it's something where, how do we relate to one another? To be able to kind of go outside the confines of fear, a lot of these fear-based aspects of, beliefs. And, of course, where it also discusses, too, going outside the prejudices of, say, abortion, homosexuality. You've got all of these points made in the book. I like that, because a lot of people right now are personally experiencing these types of, hard, confusing dilemmas in their life. And
well, you see the slip between the cup and the lip is all a matter of responsibility. We hear a lot about responsibility in our society and about how people have to take responsibility for this, people have to take responsibility for that. It's become kind of another societal cliche. The one thing that we don't take responsibility for is probably the most important thing in our lives, which is our own spirituality. And I believe that this is probably why the Gnostics, who were so much more spiritually advanced than the Orthodox Christians, lost out in that struggle, because you have to take responsibility for your own spirituality, which means that you have to make time to meditate, to seek, to find the ways to have these experiences. And most people don't. Most people are absorbed in their daily activities of survival, making a buck, taking care of the family, putting the kids through school, putting food on the table, whatever other things that they go through in the course of an average day. And it was always easier to then go into church and be absolved by a priest, with a few waves of the hand, and that was it. So essentially, the deal the priest got out of it over the years, that the church got out of it over the years, was control, and that's what the church is really all about. They want to control what your beliefs are, how you go about it, and they want to be the gateway between you and God. Now, that's not just the Catholic Church; that's really just about any church. It's because they have their own set of belief systems. They may differ, but essentially they're saying, if you want to have membership in our body, you have to buy into our story and you have to toe our line. And it's always kind of easier to do that sometimes than to really go through the hardship of a spiritual path. And a spiritual path is not an easy one. It's elusive sometimes. Once you get into it, you have steps forward and steps back. You go through dark nights of the soul. There's a lot of difficulty involved in cultivating your spiritual life. But at the end of the day, it's so worth it, because it's the ultimate road to liberation. It may be easier to give up your power to somebody else who's going to spiritually absolve you, but you're really fooling yourself, because at the end of the day, when, you know, let's say you're at the end of the life, you're kind of where you were when you started. You haven't really progressed, have you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it completely makes sense too, because when we look at everything that you know, the church asks for us to confine ourselves to and mold ourselves to all of these different, you know, doctrines of belief, and it crosses so many boundaries that get into social, moral, political views. And it's something that, you know, I like the point that you're making there. Incidentally, I want to mention something real quick. This is a little off topic, but this is a little strange, and this is something that just happened. When I host a show, I like to monitor the chat room. So I've got a couple windows that I keep open, you know, between the switchboard, the chat room, and the radio show. Well, I had, you know, I had Google up, I had Yahoo up, and I went to switch over to the chat room window, and all of a sudden I looked over, and on the status bar it says Noah's Ark through Yahoo, and I'm like, what is that? So I went to click on it, and somehow, and I know I did not put this in here because I'm paying attention to the conversation you and I are having, but somehow Yahoo just pulled up on Yahoo News Noah's Ark, and there is a whole list of links about how a longtime filmmaker, a Chinese Christian filmmaker, claims to have found the final resting place of Noah's Ark. So I just thought that was really interesting. This kind of popped up by itself. So
law of attraction.
Yeah. So, you know, it is really just interesting. But, you know, when we really look back to the origin and the truths of what I really feel that, you know, the prophets were trying to say, the Gnostics were trying to teach, that, you know, it's nice to see this be brought forth, you know, through the creation of the book that you're working through and that you're putting out, you know, and being able to share a lot of these, not traditional, but a lot of these original teachings, and be able to help people kind of, you know, butterfly outside their cocoon and find more answers and be more at peace with what they internally know, where their internal compass is actually leading them.
I tried to do this in a form that not many people are doing, which is fiction. It sounds pretty simple, but the things that you and I are talking about, don't we mostly find those in non-fictional self-help type books?
Oh, absolutely.
That you buy in a metaphysical bookstore. And, I mean, those are great. There's a lot of people out there doing that, probably a lot better than I could. But I kind of felt my calling was to use my way with words, my ability with words, and my spiritual awareness to create a story that would that people would really stick with people, and they could grow into it organically and experientially, not just theoretically, by kind of living a parallel lives with the characters in the book. And, you know, I've never read this on air before, but it's really the reason why I write. I had a little poem that kind of tells why I took this course, and it's called The Prayer of the Scribe. And it says, O Lord, grant me a poem. Let me tell a story to rend the hearts of men. True God of all things seen and unseen, breathe thy spirit into me. Let me tell a story to break the stony hearts of men, that thou may enter their shattered prisons and fill the crevices of their sorrow, and drain the swamps of their fear, and lift them from shadow to dwell in truth. Let me translate thy love into a language they will understand for all time. Allow me a poem of eternal beauty that will open the hearts of men and draw them closer to thee, and show them they are of thy realm, and assure them that thou dwellest in them. O Lord, let me tell a story frozen in eternal beauty for all generations to come that will break the iron hearts of men.
That is beautiful.
And that's the reason I write. I felt I wanted to tell a story that I hope will last for a long time and affect people in a way, come at them from a different angle, and let them start to help them start to think about these things.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about writing as well. You know, it's something that when you look at any type of form of expression, whether it's artistry, if it's authorship, if it's, you know, music, you're bringing to the table something that people are able to experience, whether it's in, you know, their own form of privacy, they can take their time deciding on what they believe, you know, how they attach to it, but it's something that transcends and it's something that continues to make an impression, you know, generation after generation. When we look at a lot of the greats, you know, a lot of the authors from so long ago, the artists from so long ago, when we look at their message, and a lot of them, of course, you know, had a message that they were predated from, you know, what the era and the time actually was in which, you know, the mass consciousness, the critical mass of understanding was able to actually embrace the teachings such as Einstein. And when we look at, you know, all of these different amazing spirits, amazing souls, and, you know, being able to use the platform of authorship, it's such a great way to reach the mass public.
Well, it was just stunning to me when I read these texts from thousands of years ago, how they were basically telling us what the truth of our existence was. It pierced the veil that, like I say, that only science is piercing now from a different direction. But 2,000 years ago, they brought us this information. They brought it in the form of myth. And, of course, they didn't have technological terms and scientific equipment, so they wouldn't describe it using the same terms and metrics that we do today. But they were saying exactly the same thing if you allow for adjustments of those differences. And it's just phenomenal that they were able to, you know, penetrate these higher dimensions and bring back information to us that we could use to better our lives and better this world. And that's a lot why I write this book, too. I want to bring that message out to the world and make people conscious of this, and they can take off from where the book is and go and study these things themselves. But it would be a life-altering experience for anybody that runs across these things, that takes them to heart. And I think the two things that you really need, and we often talk, people in the New Age, and it's become kind of a pejorative term in metaphysical communities, they often talk about affirmations and creative visualization and everything else, but the missing ingredient that a lot of people don't employ that doesn't really get them where they want to get to is that when you're using affirmations and creative visualization, you're only using half of your being. You're only using the male half of your being because you're using your logic to say, okay, I've identified what I want and I'm going to direct my thought towards it. And that's good. It's necessary and that's good. And let's call that the guidance system. But a guidance system, like on a rocket, is no good unless you have the fuel. The fuel is the feminine qualities. The fuel is the feminine quality of love, desire, and intuition. And that provides you the energy and emotional impetus to go along with that guidance system and lift that rocket of your being up to the heavens to get you where you want to be. And again, we go back to the two becoming one there.
Yeah, I really like that you put it in that perspective. You know, we use the masculine part and then we use the feminine part. And, you know, I really agree. And it's like when we take a look at how our entire species has evolved, you know, how we're really using so much more of an analytical self, an analytical mind to navigate through the world, you know, the instinct sometimes, the intuition falls away. I mean, you know, when we think back of the hunter-gatherer days, I mean, it was primarily instinct and intuition because, you know, of course there's communication, but, you know, it had to do with survival. Now, our aspects of survival are so completely different, but I think a lot of people have fallen away from that sacred feminine, fallen away from that feminine vibration of being able to just keep the balance. It's not so much, you know, overcompensating, but just to be able to keep the balance and, you know, be able to relate to one another. But, you know, really when we're looking at how things are evolving and, you know, this entire change in this movement energetically of what's happening to people across the globe. You know, of course, as they say, the veil is thinning, but, you know, really our vibrations are matching the vibrations of spirit more evenly. And so as we're seeing people have more and more experiences that are spiritually profound, I believe it's bringing them back to the balance. It's not so much that we're going through this apocalyptic time or this catalytic, you know, experience that's dark and heavy. I think it's just a matter of, you know, really, you know, the
well,
Holy Spirit.
I think what we're seeing is the feminine spirit rising.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And I mean, I can tell you that when I started this book years ago, and Mary Magdalene plays, and incidentally, I should say that Pope Annalisa is part of a trilogy. It's the first book in a trilogy called The First Souls. The First Souls is about the first spirits or to incarnate into material experience, and it traces their lives over different epochs of creation. These are archetypical souls, and the way they go is the way the world sort of seems to go spiritually. But when I started this book, Mary Magdalene plays a role in the trilogy and in Pope Annalise and in the trilogy, and there wasn't really much out there about Mary Magdalene. This is going back, say, about 10 years ago when I first had the germs of the book in my mind, and now it's like everywhere you go, there's something about Mary Magdalene over there. Everybody is coming up with an interpretation of her life, her story, her meaning, or whatever, and I think that's just indicative of the fact that we see the feminine principle rising, and this is not feminism. Feminism and the feminine energy are two different things. This isn't about equal pay, equal rights. It isn't about, you know, some feminine force rising to combat the male force. It's about the feminine force rising to rebalance the world that has gone so out of balance to the other side. It's not looking to supplant the male force. It's looking to merge with it. And I believe that is where we're heading right now and what we're seeing. So the rise in consciousness that you're talking about, at least from my perspective, has a decidedly feminine character to it, and it must, because if it doesn't, then, you know, we're going to be going around in the same circle that we've been going in, using half of our being. It's like sort of we have the rudder of the ship, but we don't have the engine, okay? We've been working with the rudder for a while, but we've been kind of floundering around the water. We now have to really get the engine on board to go somewhere, and, you know, that's what's kind of rising. That's what I see happening now.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, tell everybody about when the book is set for release, where they can acquire a copy, and what they can expect with the other two volumes coming.
Okay. The publication date for the hardcover version is June 1st. At that time, actually, I think even now it's available on the main databases from the bookstores, but it will be available. It should be available for purchase towards the end of May or June 1st. I have had an advance paperback version that is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, which I put out there for advanced test marketing. So I got a lot of, you know, fantastic comments out of Amazon reviews and everything, and that is still out there. I don't know if that's going to be discontinued, but that is available right now, the paperback version. The hardcover version, which is obviously what I'm hoping to sell, because, you know, like any new author, in order for this book to get disseminated, it has to show the publishing world sales, and the sales of the hardcover are going to be tremendously helpful to it. So if you all can afford it, I'd appreciate if you could hold off maybe a little bit, or, you know, go and inquire your bookstores about Pope Annalise on the hardcover version. But that should be available within the next, I would say, 3 weeks or so, maybe a little bit more, and it should hopefully physically be on shelves. If I can show enough sales movement, then they really start to place it on the bookshelves. But, you know, if you know anything about books, it's a very tough industry, and I guess I like it. It's the only thing, as a man, it's the only thing that I can think of metaphorically that is like a woman birthing a child. I know it's incredibly painful. I've never felt it, but I can tell you I felt the birth pangs of getting this book off the ground.
Yeah, well, in the entire publishing world has changed so much, especially now that we, you know, if you want to call it the magic, but the magic of the internet and the ability of exposure now for so many different artists, authors, musicians, and things like that, that, you know, we have this total influx of opportunity. And so therefore, it's like you've got this saturation level of, you know, people that it's, you know, trying to swim upstream. But, you know, it really is worth, I think, the effort, and, you know, it's a tremendous book. Anybody that gets the opportunity to, you know, purchase a copy and definitely to possibly hold out for, you know, the hardcover version, that would be great. Now, go ahead and, you know, let everybody know the web address and where they can explore and learn a little bit more about the book and about you.
Yeah, thank you. It's Pope Annalisa. That's one word, PopeAnnalisa.com. And it's a great website because it really wasn't set up to directly promote the book. It has a number of videos in there, very interesting. Some of them are a little bit more commercial. Some of them emphasize the spiritual side. And it's got a section of topics where many of the things that we've discussed, Mary Magdalene, the Gnostics, the merging of the ancient mystical information with modern science and quantum physics. These are all topics on the site that it goes into much more detail. So So you can almost think of the website as kind of like the making of Pope Annalisa, like you see on HBO and other things, the making of this or that movie. The website really discusses the thematic background of the book from many different viewpoints, and it also gives direct information about the book itself. The second book in the trilogy is called The 13th Disciple. I've gotten substantial portions of that written, but I don't believe it will come out for at least another year. I've kind of had to put the second two books on the shelf for now because the marketing of the first book, Debbie, I have to tell you, is absolutely a full-time job.
Yeah, no, I believe it.
Yeah, I wake up at 6 in the morning, I'm on the computer and the phone, and I literally don't get off till like 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and that's just about every day and sometimes including weekends too. You become like a shark. It's like a feeding frenzy. If you're always not moving something and pushing something, your book dies pretty quickly. So it's a full-time job, and I hope that if sales catch on and some of the initial public relations and things that I'm doing and some of the wins with the awards and everything will help out with that. If I can get to the point where I can get a little critical mass and momentum here, then I can ease off the marketing side and kind of get back to what I really want to do, which is write the other books.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, I completely understand when it comes to, you know, being able to, you know, really explore and tell people about it, you know, tell people about the book and really do a lot of the PR. It's I think, sometimes difficult these days, you know, when you're an independent, you know, freelance, whether it's author, photographer, you know, musician, et cetera. But, you know, really, it's not like it used to be, where we used to be able to just sit down and create our piece of work, and then, of course, you know, you had your whole team behind you doing their particular parts. Now we're in charge of everything, the marketing, the PR, you know, the creation of the project and everything in combination. But, you know, it really is a phenomenal book. Anybody that gets the opportunity to explore it, I very much encourage it. And, you know, it's just, it's very, very timely. With the book coming out, and so it's something that, you know, I definitely wish you the best on your, you know, your success and being able to gain more exposure with it, because the message and all of the questions that it evokes within people, I really feel is worth, you know, the time and the effort for people to definitely, you know, take a gander at it for sure.
Well, I really have a sense that the book was meant to be read, and that even though you somehow can't see the evidence of that right in front of you, which would probably make you feel better. And at this point, I really do believe, though, that there's something in this message that is so timely and so helpful to people and really so enjoyable. Remember, this is not a self-help book. This is a page-turning thriller that will have you on the edge of your seats. At least that's what everybody that's reviewed it so far has said. And the spiritual content that we're talking about doesn't hit you over the head. It's not preaching at you. It's not, again, it's not a scholarly work that's going to sit there and be dry and academic. You learn about the spiritual things we're talking about through the lives of these characters who really come to life and breathe it out to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, and it's something that really speaks volumes. And I think it's one of, to me, it's a living book. And my definition of a living book is it's something that will resonate differently with different people, but it's something that will continue to evolve. It's something that if you were to go back and, you know, reread it, say 6 months later or a year later, the perspective is different. Where you connect with it is different because your perception of the way you relate to the material is different. So, you know, that's what I like about books in this form. And, you know, I could very much see this becoming something that translates to film very easily.
Very easily. A lot of people, in fact, almost everybody that reads the book has the same comment that it should be a film. They want to see it as a film. It was written very cinematically, and it's a big, epic spiritual work. It's one of the few of our time. I happen to consider The Lord of the Rings a spiritual work. I don't know if anybody else does, but if you really look if you really deeply penetrate into The Lord of the Rings, I think it was a very spiritual work. But there are very few spiritual epics out there, fictional spiritual epics, and that's what this book is for our modern times. And I think that, in part, is what really distinguishes it when people read it. And the interesting thing is, I've had staunch Catholics read it, and they loved it. Now, they may not have gotten a lot of the spirituality out of it. It certainly caused them to question it, but they still love the book. They love the reading of it. They love the way it went. They did not feel offended. And then I have people, many of whom probably are listening to us on your radio show right now, who read it and they just are profoundly affected on a spiritual basis. And when the book has that kind of universal appeal, and it can incorporate people from so many different walks of life and have them be exposed to these ideas and notions, then I think that, you know, hopefully all the work you put into it was something that can come to fruition and be helpful to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and especially right now, you know, a lot of people are going outside the confines of what they've been taught to believe, of the direction that they've been given, you know, even as youngsters or as teenagers or as young adults. You know, they're having these experiences and these moments that are allowing them to be more relaxed about their environment of understanding spirit and being able to kind of reach beyond, you know, their I don't want to say, you know, religious experiences or influences, you know, their teachings, but people are really starting to go outside of what they've been taught to believe and really explore what they discover to know. And that's what I like about this book, because it's something that really provokes a lot of questions. It stirs a lot of curiosity because, you know, it's something that when we do look at the timing of it, you know, the timing is appropriate. And, you know, when even in the scenes in the book where, you know, she's giving her speech and, you know, you're seeing the reaction of the Vatican, and, you know, it really is very true to nature how I would expect the Vatican to react. And, you know, I have personal friends that are having these phenomenal, you know, unexplained miraculous experiences that would create this exact same type of reaction from the Vatican. So it's just really interesting. At the time that, you know, I discovered that you had the book, and, you know, when we were putting together an interview, for me personally, it was a confirmation based on other things that, you know, I've experienced in my own personal life, other friends of mine have experienced. So, you know, I really think that all of us together, as a collective, you know, as we're starting to really explore, you know, all of these truths of spirit beyond the confines of, you know, religious dogmatic interpretation and belief, it's something that, you know, is helping us find, you know, the true answers within that we haven't had the opportunity thus far to experience until now.
Well, it's my hope that, especially for young people that find themselves left outside the traditional box, no longer believing the things that our parents believed in, that there's something there for them rather than a void. And I hope that this book is one of many other things that will help fill that void for them and help give them some direction.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and it's something that I agree with when, you know, with that statement, because it's something that I know I personally resonated with, and I said, okay, all right, here we go. You know, it's good that these questions are being posed. It's good that these experiences are being written about. Even if it's fictionalized now, it really isn't based on fiction. So, you know, going back to kind of your, you know, one of your prior statements, it's really hard to write fiction on these type of topics when you have such a base and a foundation of all of these other things that, you know, have gone through history and that have gone through myth and legend and tradition and things like that.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not only that the book is based on history and actual historical documents and groups and even personages. It's also based on current world events. Now, it takes place in the near future of 2025, but the funny thing about it, Debbie, was when I wrote the book, I had to rewrite it several times because the book kept predicting world events. It predicted the first two Gulf Wars, and I had to rewrite it off of that. And finally, when it came to Iran being nuclear, and this was in the manuscripts, you know, years before we found out about Iran's, you know, current nuclear ambitions, it was part of the book. And I said, okay, I'm not rewriting it again. That's it. The buck stops here. But it's not a trendy type of thing, but it takes current world events and basically puts them in the perspective of very universal and classical themes and solutions to those dilemmas. And I think the one thing that is very interesting about this book compared to almost any other book in the market is that the resolution of the book, the resolution of the plot lines and the character arcs, are not based on the typical things of you know, politics and politics or economics or whatever. It's the solutions are spiritual. Mm-hmm. The resolutions of everything that happens in the book has a spiritual basis at the end.
Yeah. Well, we have about 60 seconds before we're going to go off live, but I just want to let everybody know that if we do go off live and we do continue just for a few more minutes, everybody, you're welcome to check us out in the archives so you can listen to the remainder of the interview. I want to reply to what you've said because it's interesting when you're talking about the prediction of the Gulf Wars and, of course, now, you know, when it's predicting, of course, Iran, you know, coming to arms with nuclear weaponry and things like that, it's a very curious thing when you receive these types of visions and when this energy is there and you receive these types of information. When it comes through, for me, authorship, like when you're writing, when you're putting this material into form, I really believe that almost every author is receiving, you know, universal information and knowledge that is coming, you know, predated, that's coming before it happens. And so it makes sense to me that this is something that you experienced. But, you know, especially Iran coming to nuclear arms, and, you know, I think in the near future, it's something that we're going to be much more intimate with as a Western society when it comes to Iran's position with the U.S. But, you know, it's just fascinating that that's something that happened to you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, when we write a meaningful book, I think we are tapping deeply into something. I mean, the way that these mystics tapped into information, I think certainly during the course of the writing of the book, I was channeling a lot of information, and I would get, you know, validations of that sometimes right after I wrote it, sometimes, you know, weeks or months later. But I had validation of so many things that in my mind, at least at the time that I thought I was writing about, were theoretical. But yes, and the thing that I, in closing, I just want to emphasize that, you know, I don't think I'm a special case or you're a special case. I think that we're all capable of having direct transformative experiences of the divine to change our lives for the better in the here and now, not have to wait in an afterlife. And I think if each of us take focused responsibility for our own spiritual growth, instead of giving our power over to governments, religions, science, whatever, that we can all achieve the type of insights and the betterment of our lives that we've been speaking about over here. So we've been speaking about here today, and that's probably maybe the greatest underlying message that I'd like to leave to people. Hopefully, if you read this book, it's not going to be an abstraction to you, but you say, wow, you know what? The things that happen in this book can happen to me in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's what I enjoyed about the book. You know, it's something that, you know, really the message is strong, and I like the fact that it just provokes a lot of questions for people that will go and explore and receive the answers for themselves. But, you know, this, I can't believe we've already gone through a full hour. You know, I could just talk to you about these all of this for, you know, on and on and on. You know, it's something that I'm really glad to have had this opportunity to do this interview today. And, you know, I wish you the most success with it. I really think it's something that, you know, people will resonate with, you know, in different aspects, in different ways. And, you know, this is something that, I guess if I can give a prediction, you know, something that I really do see going very far, because it's information people need. It's something that they're really trying to decide for themselves what their own spiritual truth is, you know, where their foundation of faith is. And, you know, the fact that it covers all of these different things, I think it's something that will help people know which path to walk, especially being that it's their own path, you know, that they need to walk instead of the path of someone else that tells them this is the way to go.
Amen.
Yay. Cool. Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you doing this, Peter. And, you know, just keep in touch with me, and I'd like to see, you know, as far as how the book goes and everything. But, you know, it'd be great to catch up with you, you know, at a later date, and, you know, especially as you're working on your second volume and, you know, talking about the success of the first and, you know, seeing what else transpires.
Well, certainly will. And, Debbie, thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you, Peter. And to all of our listeners, this has been another edition of MetaVisionaries Global Live Radio. Don't forget to check us out on our social network at metavisionaries.com, metavisionaries.com. And with that said, check out our upcoming broadcast we've got coming up over the next